Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What do you say we start with a little music to get us in the mood to talk about Wisconsin wildlife? Got a couple of chucklers here. Oh, man. The world of wildlife on our minds today here in the state of Wisconsin with a couple of great guests. David Drake and Jamie Knack. David, a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Welcome back, David.
Thank you for always having me back, Larry. It's nice
Jamie
to be here.
Jamie Knack, I don't know how you put up with him.
I don't know either. It's a challenge for sure.
Oh, man. Jamie's an outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and the two of them come by every other month, and we talk about everything going on in the world of wildlife here in the state and sometimes outside the state as well. So it's great to have them back. Certainly, if you have questions about wildlife in your area right now, maybe some questions about how to attract wildlife to your home or your area, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, and our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. So we'd love to certainly love to hear from you. So you guys have a workshop coming up on attracting wildlife, don't you, Jamie?
We do. It's called the Wisconsin Coverts Project. It's been going on since 1994 in the state of Wisconsin. Involves a number of partner organizations, mainly the Ruff Grouse Society, UW Extension, the department that David and I are in, Forest and Wildlife Ecology, as well as Sustainable Forestry Initiative has been a big supporter of the program in the past 4 years. So, but essentially the project is held at Kemp Natural Resources Station, one of the university's jewels of field stations. And we bring in speakers. It's a residential program. So it's a very intensive wildlife management program for private landowners who are interested in managing their properties for wildlife. And so we bring in speakers from a variety of organizations and agencies to, one, either talk to them about some of the wildlife groups like small mammals, herptiles, deer, rough grouse management. We also have discussions on how to conduct a successful timber harvest. We take people in the field on forestry tours so they can get a feel for different silvicultural treatments, so different cutting strategies for their woods, and then what the predicted wildlife response would be. So it's really
a lot going on there.
Yeah, giving landowners this foundation of what are the principles to manage wildlife.
You know, a good friend of mine, Kurt Westbrook, went through that program.
Remember,
and he's
Kurt?
A very, very... thought he learned an awful lot from the program and was very excited about it. And I know he's, over the years since, has shared a lot of what he learned with other people. So that's pretty cool.
And that's one of what we're looking for. So it's an application process. Applications are due June 15th. And then we take a look at those. What we're really looking for is people who are willing and able to dedicate those 4 days to the workshop, but also people who are willing to write a management plan. And then also to do outreach, as Larry suggested, being able to talk with other landowners, sharing in what they learn. So it is a true extension, train the trainer type program. There's no cost if you're accepted, because we've had excellent fundraising or grant opportunities to successfully cover those expenses. So we provide all the lodging. Scott Craven, who many of you know, does all the cooking, so you eat very well.
Very well.
And just a really nice opportunity in the Northwoods to socialize with other landowners and then have those wildlife and forestry professionals at your side to help you with specific questions.
Larry, I thought it was a blast.
Yeah, it is a great time. It's about, you know, 2.5, 3-day intensive program, as Jamie said, and Jamie's in charge of it, so I'm going to toot Jamie's horn quickly. She does a phenomenal job. There's not been one person that's come through the program that we're aware of that has not completely appreciated all the effort and what they've learned. And Jamie, I don't know if you remember off the top of your head, but do you have any statistics to share about how many people have gone through the program and how many acres have been put under management?
Yeah, so it's been, we've had over, 669 landowners, and they've influenced, so including their own property and those that they've reached out to, we're up to over 800,000 acres of land influenced in Wisconsin. We also have out-of-state landowners. We do accept landowners who own property in our adjacent states as well with similar forest types.
And how do people sign up for that or try to get involved?
So they get an application, and again, this this would be a great year to apply because we're doing two workshops. The workshop workshop dates are August 3rd to the 6th, as well as August 17th to the 20th. So you can indicate on your application which ones are your priority or preference. And then our Covert's website is just FWE, which is for Forest and Wildlife Ecology. So fwe.wisc.edu/Covert's. And another easier way to look for it is just to do an internet search for the Wisconsin Covert's Project, and it'll be one of the first links that pop up.
And that's C as in Charlie, O-V-E-R-T-S.
And I'm pretty sure we have that up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Lexi Broad, our on-air producer today, has probably already got it up there. So if you didn't get that information, go to our Facebook page and we'll definitely have it up. And if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Tim on Facebook mentioned that he's been seeing golden eagles in the lower Wisconsin River Valley in the Muscadet area, and that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, that is pretty neat. So golden eagles are typically more of a western United States species, yeah. But they have been moving into the western part of the Wisconsin, and they're a pretty common species over there now. So, and they're hard to miss. You know, they're a very large bird, and they are somewhat confusing with immature bald eagles, which we have obviously quite a few bald eagles here, and that's the more common of the two eagle species we'd have in Wisconsin is the bald eagle. But golden eagles, you know, mature golden eagles, they're not hard to confuse with many other birds other than perhaps a turkey vulture, which is also, you know, generally dark overall and big. But the way they soar is unmistakable from a turkey vulture, and it's really, really neat to see them.
You know, as long as we're talking about birds, I want to, and before we go back to the phones here, I wanted to mention the Great Wisconsin Birdathon that starts April 15th.
Yep, it's coming up.
Tax day. For those who aren't familiar, for those who aren't familiar with that Birdathon, maybe you can tell us about what's the purpose and so forth.
Yeah, so the Great Wisconsin Birdathon runs from April 15th to June 15th. And this is maybe the third or fourth year they've been doing this. It's the purpose of it, really, is to kind of educate people about birds. And most importantly, it's a fundraising effort for bird conservation in the state of Wisconsin. And so people can form as teams or that you can join an established team. And the idea is that you would go out and over the course of a 24-hour period, you try to find as many birds as you possibly can. And it's all on your honor, you know, so you're expected to be honest about what you see or what you hear. And you can be an expert birder, and some of the teams you'll see there are some of the best birders in the state of Wisconsin, if not in the country. But you can also be a novice birder, and maybe this is the first time you've ever gone out birding. So it's meant to get people out, introduce them to birding, avian conservation, and things like that. But it's a phenomenal thing. You can do it. You can go statewide if you want to do that for your 24-hour birdathon. You can stay in your backyard, your own backyard. You can stay local in your city, your neighborhood, whatever the case is. So, but the real purpose is to draw awareness for avian conservation in the state of Wisconsin, and most importantly, to generate some funds or some money to support avian conservation.
And I think we've got a link on our Facebook page to the Wisconsin Birdathon, isn't it?
Yep.
WisconsinBirdathon.org. And I encourage you to go to that website. You don't have to join a team. You can just pledge. But it's really fun to look at the records and the species list that come in through those 2 months.
I know Scott Craven's had a team in the past. After me well, he didn't care if I joined the team. He just wanted me to give him
money.
Just
wanted your money, yeah.
He just wanted my money. Yep.
Well, it does go to a good cause. They've raised over $200,000 in the 5 years it's been going on. And I don't know what their goal is this year, but they broke their goal last year of they ended up raising $77,000.
Yeah, which is pretty impressive.
So, yeah.
And there's about 400 or so, roughly 400 bird species in the state of Wisconsin. And last year, the top team found or identified 192 bird species within a 24-hour period. So That's pretty good. Yep, almost
they
half.
They must have been spread out across the state.
They were moving around the state, and those were some expert birders, and so
lots of coffee.
They had a lot of coffee, and obviously you can do this. You can identify birds by sight or sound, and this is not necessarily anything unique to Wisconsin. This goes on in other states around the country, where it's kind of a fun contest to see who can identify what birds and raise money for avian conservation.
We have Marcus in Milwaukee up with a question, so let's go there. Hi, Marcus. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. So my question is, what would your guess say is one of the most notable or significant changes that has occurred in American forestry since the beginning days with Gifford, Penshaw, and Shank when they were at Biltmore first establishing forestry in this country?
That sounds like a PhD prelim question.
Yeah, forest management. So changes in forest management over the years. Boy, that's a big question.
I'll throw a couple things. I've got a PhD in forestry from North Carolina State, so I'm a wildlife biologist, not necessarily a forester, even though I have a PhD in forestry. But I'll throw a few things out that, and again, I think this is a good discussion. You could probably get a pretty good argument started amongst professionally trained foresters as well. But for one thing, is just the amount of science that's being brought to forest management these days, and there's a tremendous amount of science that's gone into harvesting trees, regenerating forests, how to manage and maintain forests, and things like that. There's a lot more forest land in the United States now than when the European settlers came here, and part of that is the way that we've developed the landscape and our relationship with trees and things like that. But you've also seen, I think, some of the forested communities change. Some of it is due to climate change. Some of it is due to human influence and things like that, and how we manage forests and what we manage forests for. But the other issue is if you look at some of the United States Forest Service policies, that some of the court battles and congressional acts for multi-use of national forests, for example. So forests originally were looked at as a timber source, but now they're looked at as a timber source, a recreational opportunity, aesthetics, and a whole host of other things that are mandated by congressional acts that you have to manage for multiple use on, especially national forest land. Yeah. So there's a bunch of different, I think, again, depending on who you talk to, you probably will get a little bit of a different flavor of an answer. But I think certainly the research and the science has gone into it, how we manage forests and how we look at and treat forests these days has changed drastically since Pinchot and some of the other people have come through have been influential in the forest management.
Interesting question. Thanks, Marcus.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Dave and Slinger up next. Dave, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. When do the Orioles return?
When they get here.
They return the same day every year to my place.
Have you seen Orioles yet?
No.
I have not.
It's always usually May 1st.
Yeah, I haven't seen them or heard
Getting
them yet
close.
Either. But
maybe even end of April, start looking and get some oranges out. But we're not quite there yet.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Again, you can join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to hear from you. We have Mary in Madison called to ask about possible vote in Congress about opening a crane hunting season. I don't know if you guys have any information on that or not.
Well, this is part of the spring hearings, Conservation Congress elections and the spring hearings. And so this is one of the advisory questions, trying to get a feeling from the public on their appetite for a sandhill crane hunting season in the state.
No pun intended.
And just really asking if they support legislation that would give the DNR authority to begin the process to develop a hunting season. I was reading up a little bit about this. Within the U.S., I believe there's like somewhere between 10 and 15 states where it is legal to hunt sandhill cranes. And within our flyway, there are two states that have legalized it. But again, this is just, getting the pulse and how the public feels about it. And then this would be, the results are non-binding. Those are advisory that go to the Natural Resources Board. And in the case of a sandhill crane season, that would require a state law change before that could go into effect. So as you can imagine, not to necessarily bring up another controversial topic with wolves, but it's the same thing. I mean, there are views on either side of that issue.
And in terms of the Congress itself, when does the Congress meet and that sort of thing?
Well, these hearings that we're talking about are coming up April 10th. They're held in every county of the state, so all 72 counties, and they all start at 7 o'clock. Hearings usually go for 1 to 3 hours, and they gauge public support on fishing, hunting, conservation, and environmental issues. And the various questions are, again, presented as advisory. So, again, just getting everybody's welcome to attend. There's no fee to attend. You don't need a special invitation.
Don't need to be a hunter or a fisherman or anything like that.
All the bird watchers are more than welcome to go, right? And then they go through a series of fishery advisory questions and then wildlife questions. And then also Conservation Congress representatives for the various counties are elected on those nights as well.
Also, as a side note, Larry, so sandhill cranes are back here in Wisconsin now. They've been back for probably a month or so, maybe a little bit more than that. But my family and I just drove out last week to Colorado to go skiing, and we went through the Platte River area of Nebraska, which is a major concentration of sandhill cranes. And we were a little bit late seeing them out there, but they're still, we saw hundreds of them. And in one field, we counted, you know, we're going 70 miles an hour, but we estimated there's thousands in one particular field. It's a pretty impressive sight to see so many of any animal of one species, but especially those cranes, because they're just so majestic and tall, and they're a really pretty animal.
Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guests today. Again, you can join us with your own questions or comments or maybe sightings at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Broad, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn talks with a Milwaukee high school music teacher who's been nominated for a Grammy Music Educator Award. That's at 2 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake. And we'll go back to our phones. Jim and La Crosse up next. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
I live in an area where kind of birds are used as an excuse to sort of limit people's access to land. Is there any evidence that says that, and specifically mountain biking, bicycles to public lands, is there any evidence out there that shows that mountain bikes are detrimental to birds or wildlife or anything like that? Or is this just sort of a something that people just made up?
Well, John or Jim, that's a good question. I am not aware of any scientific literature that has looked at the effect of mountain biking on birds. But Jamie and I have a colleague in our department, Dr. Anna Pigeon, who's looked at hiking trails up in the Baraboo Hills and bird nests and the distance from bird nests and successful nest production relative to hiking trails. And I'm trying to think back, Jamie, correct me if I'm wrong, if you recall this, but I believe that the closer the bird nests were to the hiking trails, the less productivity those bird nests have. And there are other documented studies where human activity obviously does have effect on birds, and it depends on what you want to talk about. Is it birds being in the area, birds establishing territory, birds being productive in terms of nesting, things like that? But there are plenty of studies out where other human activities, for example, if you come into an area and you build houses, that typically you have fewer birds and less nest productivity the closer you get to that housing development for a variety of reasons. One being that people have cats, free-roaming cats, and those cats are destructive to the bird population. But it's also human activity out and about that sometimes the birds aren't used to that, and it pushes the birds a little bit further out of that area. So, I'm not specifically aware of studies that have looked at mountain biking in particular, but there are plenty of other studies that have looked at a variety of human activity.
Yeah.
And there is some...
Even hiking,
yep. And there is some evidence there that human activity of a variety does have a negative impact on birds and nest productivity and things like that.
All right. Thank you.
Any differential between mountain biking and hiking? Because I know hiking has a little bit more tendency for people to leave the trail and then go out into the bird nesting areas, whereas mountain bikes
stay on the trail.
Right.
Yeah, sure. With the mountain biking trails I'm familiar with here in the Madison area, I do know that they get pretty heavy use, and that's the question is, it's not a matter of people stay on the trail. It's about how many people are coming by that spot every single day, and mm-hmm. can a bird acclimate to that and things like that. Because when the bird's on the nest, if that nest is close to a mountain biking trail or hiking trail or whatever the case is, if somebody comes by and that bird gets nervous, they'll flush off that nest. And so obviously then when the mom is off the nest, it affects the incubation temperature of the eggs. It makes the nest susceptible to predators when the mom's not there and things like that. So that's the question, is not hiking versus mountain biking, but it's the frequency of use of that trail and how often somebody comes by that might negatively affect that bird.
Yeah. Jim, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give some others a chance to join in here. And I want to go to Joanne in Monona next. It's her turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last week, I was on a hike with my friend at Natural Bridge State Park. And we saw some evidence of animal, quote unquote, attacking some dead trees. And there is extensive damage, and oftentimes there is a big pile of chips at the base of the tree, and some of this damage was close to the ground, and some of it was as high as 15 feet off the ground.
Yeah, are they holes? A lot of
well,
them
it
are
was,
shredded? Or
it looked as if they were going after the insects in the dead trees.
Yeah.
And it was more of a chip thing.
Okay.
Everything I've looked up online has talked about animals going for the cambium.
Mm.
So my theory was it was bears.
Well, I think Jamie's got something
to add. Yeah, so you did a great job of describing it, made it pretty easy. I think David and I had this one figured out. But pileated woodpecker. And so if you would do a search for that bird and just feeding sign, you would see snags, or what we call standing dead trees, pictures of them. And as they chisel out the dead tree to be able to get at insects or material within that snag. So that is our largest of the woodpecker species.
Right.
And not frequently seen, but heard.
Right.
But yeah, so pileated woodpecker would be our guess there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll go look at those.
Yeah, do that, please.
Yeah, do that for sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Speaking of birds, John called in to say that he saw an osprey in Amory for the first time this
very
spring.
Cool.
Yeah, very, very nice. That's awesome.
Very fun
spring,
birds to watch.
Spring is coming.
Yeah. Daniel in Oak Hill. Hi. Thanks for calling.
I'm just wondering, in a way it's all birds. We have a lot of birds that used to pass through Oak Hill, but they cut all the trees down with that new sand mine. So does that mean, do they have to replant those, or is there or anything to that effect for the animals?
So I'm guessing that's private property. Is that right?
I would presume they bought it. It's all on a ridge, and, like you said, they cut off, I don't know, they probably cut 20 acres, but the sand mine's only like a mile down the road.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So it depends on a couple of things, Daniel. Well, if it's public or private. If it's private land, they are welcome to do more or less what they want as long as they don't negatively affect their neighbors. But the other consideration is if that land was in managed forest law, which is a state tax break for forest landowners. And if it's a managed forest law, there are some conditions in that contract that the landowner would have to abide by. And so if they are allowed to cut some trees down, but they would have to replant under some of those conditions of the managed forest law. So it would depend. But if they're not under managed forest law and it's private property, they're welcome to do as they wish on that property. They can cut all the trees, and they can pave it over and put basketball hoops up if they want to. They don't have to replant anything.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I hear you. Next to animals so much, and my daughter's really upset about it. she says, you know, it was so pretty over there, and now they cut it all down. And they're not building houses over there. They're not doing nothing. It's been almost 2 years, and they haven't.
So one thing maybe to kind of assuage your daughter's anxiety or concern over that is, you know, cutting trees and either there's a variety of ways you can harvest trees. You could clear cut them. You could single cut trees. You know, a variety of stuff. And anything we do in management to manage the habitat, you always have losers and you always have winners. And so, although the trees are cut down and species that might use those trees, they may have to move out of that area, but they're going to move to the next available adjacent area that has suitable habitat for them. But as you cut those trees, you're opening up the habitat and you're creating what's called early successional habitat. And there's a lot of other species that will then move in and use that early successional habitat. And as a matter of fact, depending on what's there, some of the species that are really struggling for survival and the populations are declining are grassland birds because there's just not enough open habitat. So as they open that habitat up, it may benefit some other species that really need that habitat. And the species that are moving out, they're going to go and be able to find some other suitable habitat in the nearby area.
Okay, Jamie, you wanted to add?
Yeah, Daniel, I just wanted to, another thing to reassure your daughter with is to stress the importance of public property. So whether that be our state park system, the variety of public opportunities we have that we set aside and conserve, not necessarily protect. We're still doing the forest management, as David mentioned, for the variety of species. But between our national forests and state parks and public properties, there are areas that are being managed for the natural resources. And again, just to plug the coverts program again, but that's an attempt to educate and inform and make available resources to private landowners who own woodlands and are interested in managing. They're interested in learning how to manage for wildlife, and that's kind of what the goal is for that program. So while that property, unfortunately, is changing, there's a lot of other good work being done around the state.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Daniel. Clay in Madison has something for us. Clay, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had read something last year that the Audubon Society had put out, and they said that they estimated conservatively that cats take about 1 billion birds a year, and I think that was just the United States. And I found that to be just mind-blowing. And it may or may not be true, but what is your take on cats as an invasive species?
Well, I don't know that they're labeled an invasive species legally, so they'd be still a domestic animal, but they might be invasive in nature in terms of the damage that they cause. So certainly science does support the impacts that they have on wildlife populations, and not just birds, but small mammals and reptiles and amphibians as well. So from a wildlife management standpoint, most of our colleagues are going to support the keeping cats indoors. And the other thing to look at in terms of for cat owners is that cats have half the life expectancy when they're allowed to be outside. They have a lot of risks associated with being outside in terms of vehicles, predators, diseases from wild animals, and so on. So for all of those reasons, we recommend and encourage people to keep their cats inside. There is, if you go to the Audubon Society website or ABC, the American Bird Conservancy, with their Cats Indoors campaign, additional information about why we're advocating that from on behalf of birds. But there's also a lot of interest in catios right now. So outdoor cat patios, which are allowing the cats to be outside, but they're basically in an enclosed sunroom or four-season porch or three-season porch, but allowing them that opportunity to be outside but not have the access to the wildlife.
I just, for some strange reason, came across catios yesterday.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's a big page dedicated to catios in Portland, Oregon. So if you've never seen a catio before, just do an internet search on Portland, Oregon catios. And it's a phenomenon out there. Yeah. Yeah, just like patio, but with a C. It's the craziest thing.
Well, hopefully it takes off. It would maybe be some middle ground.
Might be.
Thanks, Clay, for calling. Karen in Genoa, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. Yeah, and it's Genoa. The Genoa, Genoa, Wisconsin. So we're right along the river, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But anyway, quickly my question. It's about bluebirds. Number one, do bluebirds pair up, you know, year after year as a couple, so to speak? And number two, I do have bluebird houses distributed out and around. And I think with some of the reading I've done, I feel in my own heart that I have quite a sanctuary for bluebirds. I only see a pair come every year. I've seen bluebird eggs and not necessarily in my bluebird houses, but I have these stumps that were carved, they're hollowed out, and they're painted, you know, for decorative purposes.
Sure.
And I've had the bluebirds actually make a nest in there, and it's less than 12 inches down, so maybe like 6 inches down.
Yeah.
And I've had bluebird eggs that have just sat there, and they left the nest, the parents. And I've had bluebird eggs hatch where there's just the babies, you know, there's just little feathers. They're not completely feathered out, and I peek in there and they're dead.
Yep.
So I put a little roof over the top. I mean, they're able to get in and out. Just, I was thinking, would it be the heat? Would it be flies? Would it be...
Could be a number of things.
Yeah, so thanks, Karen. I'm going to start by giving you a resource to look at that I think you'll really enjoy and has a lot of information, and that is the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. And so it's braw.org. And obviously they're dedicated solely to bluebirds. So there's a lot of information on bluebird houses, placement, how to handle black flies, predation, all sorts of great resources on that website. So I definitely want to mention that at the beginning. You know, traditionally without an artificial bluebird house, they may nest in like rotten out fence posts within a pasture or in a field. You're doing the right thing by putting out the bluebird houses in terms of what's predating them in that the wood that you described or even in the houses. It could be temperature related. It could be exposure to the cold spring rains without having that roof. That might have been something that factored into the death of those nestlings. There are other birds that might remove the eggs, like brown-headed cowbirds. Certainly black flies can play a role later in the summer. So there are a number of things, and some of those we can fend off in terms of building proper houses or houses that have been researched in terms of air control or air venting and being able to have a roof on that house. So again, I'd encourage you to go back to that website and do some additional looking and see what else you might be able to do to protect them from predators, even putting on a predator guard or wrapping the post in metal so that so raccoons can't get up it, you know, things like that are all things that you might consider doing.
Even the size of the opening.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have the wrong size opening, I had someone on from the Bluebird Association.
Yep.
And you can turn your bluebird house into
to
a great
death trap.
Owl feeder.
Yep.
Oh,
and whether
yeah.
you have a perch or not, and all sorts of things. Yep.
And another thing, I mean, this has happened to us, but both tree swallows and house sparrows can also get in there and peck on the head of the adult sitting on the nest and can kill. You know, they're a little more aggressive in terms of claiming that nest box. So there are additional things you can do to deter house sparrows and bluebirds and just putting up more houses as well.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give others a chance to join in. Let's go to Ernest in Vernon County. Hi, Ernest. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've started a project this spring because of trying to eradicate buckthorn, and I'm loosely tacking this onto the show of forest management. I purchased a weed burner, and I am trying to girdle my buckthorn,
mm-hmm.
when it's wet, in hopes of being able to kill it. I have a massive amount of it, but it's very labor intensive to try and kill it. You have to cut it and then put the saw down and then paint something like a Roundup on it to kill it. I'm thinking this might work, and I just thought I'd put it out, and maybe some other listeners could take this project on too.
It's a miserable thing, that buckthorn, isn't it?
Yep.
I tell you,
it's a heroic battle, it's the right thing to do.
It's a worthwhile battle, but it's
labor intensive. So, Ernest, if you were to go to the DNR website and look under invasive plant species management, they have fact sheets for all of the species that are talking about current recommended herbicide treatments, cuttings, you know, whatever might be the best practice. Currently. So that's one resource. And the other would be IPAW, which is the Invasive Plants Association of Wisconsin website. And those would be two excellent resources to go and look at and see what they're recommending. And the other possibility is just to contact your local forester within the DNR, your local DNR office, and get their advice on what's been working in your area.
Yeah.
The problem with all these invasive species is you can be a responsible landowner and manage for invasive species in your property, but if your neighboring landowners are not doing the same, it's a
never-ending battle.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. There we go. Thanks, Ernest. Appreciate the call. Talking today with Jamie Nack and David Drake from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and from the University of Wisconsin Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. If you have a wildlife question or maybe a wildlife experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Larry Mueller here with my guests Jamie Nack and David Drake as we talk the world of wildlife in Wisconsin. Number to call, 800-642-1234. If you got a great wildlife photo, we'd love to see that up on our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's our title of our page. And we'll talk about those photos that you might put up. We always love to see them. And, of course, email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joan and Rudolph up next. Thank you, Joan, for calling.
Thanks. Say, speaking about chemicals, I was just wondering, when we spray these trees or inject trees for emerald ash borers, as an example, how does that insecticide then, it's in the larva of whatever is in there, and a woodpecker comes in and tries to clean out that larva that's in the tree, and I've seen where woodpeckers then get sickened and die as a result of the insecticides that we're pumping into these trees trying to save them. And, and how does that affect, those things, those non-targeted species? And are we doing the right thing?
Yeah, Joan, that's a good question. A couple of responses to that is, number one, the ash borer obviously has the ability to kill ash trees, and that's the real negative consequence to having emerald ash borers, the insect here in Wisconsin and other parts of the United States. But typically, woodpeckers don't attack trees that are alive. They will only excavate and work on trees that are dead, where the insects are. And I'm not sure that with the emerald ash borer, there's a lot of chitin on that animal or a lot of external skeleton on that animal. I'm not sure if woodpeckers actually eat the emerald ash borer or not. And most of the insecticide they're using, all of the insecticides that are being applied for emerald ash borer control or whatever the case might be, if the applicator is doing it responsibly and ethically and legally, they should be following all of the EPA label directions on the back of that insecticide or herbicide or whatever the pesticide is. And as long as they're doing that, it should be safe for the environment, because that's one of the conditions to get an EPA label, is that you have demonstrated that it's safe for non-target animals, it's safe for the environment, and if it's not, then you are specifically directed to use that insecticide in a particular way to make it as safe as possible. So, the bigger issue and the bigger effect on birds is just the loss of ash trees in general, because ash trees are such a great food source, especially a late winter food source for birds and other animals, that when they really, really need it at kind of a critical period during the year. So that's the larger issue. And I'm not necessarily aware of woodpeckers being killed from eating insecticide-laden insects, but I'm also not terribly familiar with that part of the literature either. But I think if the insecticides are being applied responsibly, legally, ethically, it really should limit drastically non-target species and secondary poisoning and things like that.
Yeah, there we go. And it's typically applied in not to all the trees. It's applied to certain ash trees that you want to save one or whatever.
You try to save it. That's right.
Yeah, I imagine they would have real well read on this either, but that you would probably do it within a perimeter, around the perimeter and just go ahead and sacrifice the ones in the middle. But I'm not sure either.
There we go, Joan. That's the best we can do for you today. Appreciate your call. Mark in Wisconsin Dells, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Good to hear from you. I listened to the lady talk about the damage to the trees and the comments about the woodpeckers, and the comment was seldom seen. And I guess that used to be our case, but we see them all the time. We got lots of videos of woodpeckers, the pileated woodpeckers around Jordan Lake, at least on my street, have broken all the mirrors in all the cars in my neighborhood, the grill on a neighbor's pickup truck, and the headlight on my wife's car. So, we're trying to find out if they taste good, but being facetious. But apparently, this is a common problem in some places, and I have a friend, a neighbor who goes to Puerto Rico every winter, and he says everybody down there knows to wrap their mirrors with towels anytime they leave their cars.
Yeah, that was going to be my suggestion, Mark, was if it was, the side mirrors on a vehicle is just to cover them with something when you park in your driveway. But hopefully this is just going to be a seasonal issue when they're in the breeding season and they're seeing their reflection and acting aggressively because they think it's a foe in the mirror when it's actually themselves. So anything you can do to break up that reflection. Obviously, if you have the opportunity to put your car in a garage, that would be wonderful, but you probably don't. So certainly covering up those mirrors and making them not visible to the birds would be very helpful. This is very common as well with window strikes, robins or cardinals being aggressive at a window and attacking themselves. And anything you can do to break up that reflection, whether it's putting something opaque on the window or just covering it for the couple of weeks that it's happening, it'll encourage them to go somewhere else.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks so much for calling. Boy, even breaking a headlight.
Yeah. That could get expensive.
Yeah, it gets expensive. Thanks, Mark. Oh, boy. Greg in Brookfield. On to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Larry. Got a question for Dave and Jamie there. I've got a big facility in Pewaukee where one of my favorite critters is a chipmunk. I just love them. They're just so sweet, and they're very fearless.
Yeah.
But what has happened, I live in Brookfield, and they had went in and tore out a quarry there and cleared a lot of the land in there. And here in this last year since they've done that, a lot of the wildlife has moved into, the surrounding area. And one of the critters that I have never, ever seen, and I've been here almost 13 years, were chipmunks. And now I've got quite a few of them. Two of them live under my garage and along the air conditioner. And what has happened now with them clearing all that out, we've got an abundance of hawks. And they're killing the birds, the little birds, like goldfinches. They're even going after some of the red-headed woodpeckers. And I'm wondering if there's anything that I can put out to deter them from, the land here. You can't get rid of them, but at least on my land, and I've got quite a wide open, lot with another lot, and I'm trying to keep them somewhat at bay to give the animals a chance, because in the spring I'm going to put in about $3,000 or $4,000 worth of plants where they can hide. Because I want to try to keep them, and I just love chipmunks. They sit on the front porch and eat the grapes and the sunflower seeds and the peanuts. But is there anything I can do other than, like I said, go out and put a whole bunch of plants in?
Well, a couple things, Greg. I think if you want to give Larry your address, I'm sure there's a lot of people in Wisconsin who would love to drop their chipmunks off for you. Because I think you're in the minority in terms of loving them in that regard. But, you know, a couple of things here. As a good friend of ours, Jason Succo, says, you know, bird feeders are bird feeders. And the animal that you've got coming by to eat the other birds is either probably a sharp-shinned hawk and or a Cooper's hawk. And both of those are what we call accipiters. They're a smaller hawk. But they're very common around bird feeders because they will eat other birds like robins and chickadees and things that you've mentioned there. So a couple of things to do is, you know, and for the sharp-shinned hawk and Cooper's hawks, that's their natural tendency to do because they have to eat as well. So a couple of things, you can either just continue to allow some of the smaller birds to serve as prey for those accipiters. And don't worry about the population because the birds you mentioned are very, very common. There's a lot of them around. It's not going to affect the population at all. It's obviously unfortunate for that one individual or a couple of individuals that get killed. So you can, number one, not worry about it. Number two, if you want to try to take your bird feeders down, then you will not concentrate some of those smaller songbirds at the feeding station. And you, because there's not as many songbirds around, you then may start limiting the frequency or the visitation of either the sharp-shinned hawk or the Cooper's hawk or both of those birds. Or if you want to leave the bird feeders up, as you mentioned, one thing to do is to provide better shelter and cover for the smaller songbirds that are serving as prey. So typically make sure that you would have your bird bath or your feeding stations, your bird feeders, within a relatively short fly or a hop so that they can get quickly off of that bird feeder into some cover where the sharp-shinned hawk or the Cooper's hawk would not be able to get at them.
There we go.
One hawk that's got to be about 20 inches tall. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, if it's about that size, it's probably a Cooper's hawk. So if you have a bird book or do an internet search on Cooper's hawk or sharp-shinned hawk.
Yeah.
And is there anything on any of the websites that I can actually look up anything on the chipmunk situation?
Well, so the chipmunks, for one thing, obviously the chipmunks, they also are a prey base, and there's a bunch of chipmunks, so that population is overall doing very, very well. You know, it's unlikely probably that the sharp-shinned hawk or the Cooper's hawk are eating the chipmunks. They tend to typically focus more on birds. But chipmunks also get very, very smart, and when they know there's a predator around, especially if it's frequently around, they will stick closer to the hole so that they can duck into the burrow very quickly. Their guard will be up. They'll become much more vigilant. And those that are not, obviously they'll lose their life, but the other ones that are alive will quickly learn how to avoid predation as much as they possibly can.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Mike and Eau Claire a chance to join us. Mike, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm just calling about an interesting observation on the Gordon Flowage last year in March. We were ice fishing, and five, I think, trumpeter swans were flying over quite low, and all of a sudden one young male spotted a buoy in the water that was white, had a black rod out of it and a red little knob and head, and it got decoyed in.
Yeah.
And flew down and landed next to the buoy and then started walking around it for about a minute and turned around and looked and saw another buoy about 100 yards away started running across the ice and flew about 3 or 4 feet off the ice and landed right next to the other buoy and started walking around. So it must have been a young male looking for a mate.
Oh,
that's very funny. That's a good story.
That's a great story.
Yeah, we've been seeing trumpeters flying over the house. We're in Columbia County the last couple of weeks, so they've certainly been around. And last night we were treated to a single trumpeter on the pond and got to watch it forage and prune itself for a while. So beautiful animals for sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed the show.
Yeah, thanks Mike. Appreciate it. And speaking of sightings, we've got some great photos up. I just want on Facebook. Let's see. Bev sent us a great photo of a wood duck pair.
Yep, that's beautiful.
Beautiful shot.
Those males in particular are just gorgeous.
Let's see. Where did I go here? I had. And then we have a shot from Meredith, last week, this is near Salem, Wisconsin, a nice photo here. She said, I was driving home in a large puddle in a cornfield, had 20 or so snow geese located floating in it. The rest, the snow geese had been, I think the nest, the next morning, the snow geese had been replaced with what looked like two swans.
Yep.
They turned into two swans.
Yeah, that's right. And the picture you have on the Facebook page are not of snow geese. Those are of swans for
right.
sure.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yep. for sure. And let's see.
Oh, look at that.
We've got Janie sent a shot of.
Yeah, it looks like a barred owl.
Looks like a barred owl to me as well. Great photo. And let's see. Well, some
cloud shots.
Some nice photos up on our Facebook
really
page.
Are.
If you've got
if you've got a great wildlife photo, I hope you will post it up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Sharon in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, thanks for the program.
Sure.
I have a question. Actually, it's a competition going on in my backyard. I have what I think are a pair of Merlin hawks nesting for the second year. And we have also got in an adjacent 60-foot pine, we have crows or blackbirds of some kind, also nesting. And then last night I heard a great horned owl out there. Huh? And so I'm wondering who's going to win.
Well, Sharon, it's unlikely that Merlins are nesting in your yard because Wisconsin's not in their breeding habitat. So Merlins typically, if you look at a bird book, a range map, they're more of a western species, but they are down along the Gulf Coast of Mexico during the wintertime, and then they'll fly through Wisconsin to get to Canada, but they do not typically nest in Wisconsin.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests. They'll be with us right up till about 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today, Larry Mueller here, and having a lot of fun talking with my two guests, Jamie Nack, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David Drake, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Always fun to have them come by, and I'm glad you're listening in, and I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Julian Madison has a question for us, so let's go there. Julie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, with all the talk about threats to our birds, I'm wondering about all these glass banks and hotels and all, and if that's totally legal or if there's something they can do to deter the birds from flying into them.
Well, there certainly is stuff they can do. A lot of it, unfortunately, when we're talking about buildings with a lot of glass, needs to be considered in the construction point or at the construction stage. So birds, again, collide with windows for two reasons. One, they may see it as a pass-through. So in other words, there might be windows on both sides of the walls. Oh. So they actually see right through the building or our living rooms and think they can pass through and then hit the window. Or they're seeing reflections, and they're seeing either their own reflection, which we were talking about earlier in terms of being aggressive towards what they see as a competing male, or they see reflections of the landscape, the clouds, the trees and things like that, and think that it's additional habitat and they just fly into it. So anything you can do to break up those reflections, if it is a see-through situation and you can close some drapes or you can block a set of the windows, that can break that up. But in terms of building from the ground up with these buildings, there are ways to tilt the windows to have that reflection not be visible to the birds. And I'm sure there are additional things, too, that are being done to just kind of break that reflection, whether it's putting something, a silhouette on the window or something opaque to block it as well. Around homes and stuff, too, you can put plant shrubs and trees near the window so that it gives them a barrier.
Yeah, it gives them a little barrier.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more awareness now amongst architects and builders and things like that about bird-friendly building design and lack of windows and things like that. But with that being said, you know, the new Minnesota Viking Stadium, the U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis, is all glass on a couple of sides of it, and there's a lot of concern about birds being killed during migration period over there. But the other issue is the American Bird Conservancy has got some wonderful resources on their website about how to make glass safe, windows safe for birds. And they're also doing a lot of research in conjunction with the Pittsburgh Paint and Glass Company to design new glass that is bird-friendly.
Oh, so there's really interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff going on. And just like we've talked about cats and the destruction about cats toward birds, glass buildings, you know, it's been estimated that kill millions of birds a year across the United States and Canada because of some of the issues Jamie talked about.
There's another initiative, too, called Lights Out, and it's an initiative to make sure lights are turned off in these buildings at night because many of the migratory birds are migrating at night, and they get distracted or confused with the light source. And so there's an encouragement, especially in some of the more urban areas, with this idea of lights out because that's another reason why they're colliding with those windows.
And you mentioned cats, and I want to go back to our Facebook page for just a second because someone posted a photo of a catio or a patio for cats, and this one happens to be a sun catcher, it's called, and just make that a little bigger.
That's just beautiful.
It's something. There it is. So a little information on a catio. Well,
some of those look like nice stuff that I wouldn't mind lounging in there.
You could lounge in there with
Absolutely.
Your cat.
Nice warm sunny day.
Yeah.
So there you go. Well, we've got more callers. Jamie in Green Bay up next. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. We were just watching a family of, I believe it's downy woodpeckers. There's an old box elder stump in the backyard, and we'd watched one adult woodpecker make a perfectly round hole in it. Pretty soon there was a mate, and now there are, I think, two juveniles. And we were watching them flying around the stump, and it looked like one of the adults was playing hide-and-seek with the little ones. It'd hide on one side of the tree, and the little ones would swoop around it, almost like it was training them how to go after and harass a hawk or something. I don't know what we're watching, but that's the story I made up to go with it anyway.
Well, that's
they've been just a ball to watch right out the back window.
Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it? Oh, man. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Yeah, lucky to have, you know, a sighting so close, just to be able to observe from inside. So
And I didn't know if you had any insight as to if my story's anywhere near true. Or
oh, I think it is true. They certainly would excavate a nest, and certainly nest in hollow cavities, and that seems about right for the number of young and timing. So they're getting an early clutch out.
Yeah, that's great.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate the call. Don in Minocqua up next. Hi, Don.
Hello. Just an interesting Merlin thought. We have a cottage on Tomahawk Lake, and several years ago we had Merlins nesting in a tree outside the cottage. And it did fledge several chicks. And one of the, and we knew the when the eagle came around, the Merlins would take out after the eagle and chase it. And for several years after that, we had Merlins on the lake. We haven't seen any recently, though, but that is one instance, anyway, when a Merlin did nest in Wisconsin.
Well, are you sure it's a Merlin, Don?
Yes.
Okay, so, all right, I will give you this one because you're far enough north, but typically Merlins typically don't nest in Wisconsin simply because they go further north up in Canada to do so, or they go further west. But I will give you, since you're far enough north, I will allow this to occur on the radio station today.
There we go. Thanks, Don.
One more thing. We had one of the fledglings got out of the nest and managed to get down to the ground, but it couldn't fly. We have a wildlife center up here, and we called the wildlife center. They came and picked up the baby Merlin, and they finished raising it, and then later in the year released it.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
That is very neat. Thanks, Don. I appreciate that call. Yeah, you can never say never.
No, you cannot. That's right. That's exactly
Scott
right.
Scott Craven always talks about the person who called about the prairie dog.
Yep.
And Scott said, there are no prairie dogs in Wisconsin, and there was one.
That's right.
Came in on a bale of hay, a round bale of hay from out west.
Yep.
Oh, man. And all by itself for a few years, which that had to have been tough.
It had a lonely life.
It had a lonely
life. But it did live a number of years. So.
Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Thanks, Don. Lisa in Winona, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. I just have a quick story I want to share. I always thought that Blue Jays and Cardinals were enemies. So I was doing the dishes one day, and there was a Cardinal on the ground, and this little Blue Jay. They looked at each other. They hopped towards each other. Just pecked each other on the beak real soft, like they were giving each other a kiss, and they hopped away.
So the question is, what color does red and blue make? So,
yeah.
It was so cool. I wish I would have got a picture of it. It was so cool.
Yeah, we feed birds in the winter here, and certainly have both of the species at the feeders at the same time. So they, you know, hop around each other a little bit, but they do seem to tolerate each other fairly well.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And by the way, someone else I think had emailed in to ask about
feeders, right?
Feeders, yeah. And when to put stop
for the winter
with your winter bird feeding. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so we're getting pretty close as things start to green up here, and we've got more native plants and trees available to them, their native sources. You're going to see your feeders have less activity to begin with, and that's probably a pretty good clue that you can pull those down. But it's time to replace your safflower and your sunflower seeds and suet with hummingbird feeders and maybe mealworms for those bluebirds and some oranges and grape jelly for the orioles. So it's just a matter of changing what you're putting out there. Yep. But we're pretty close.
The only consideration I'll throw out there, I agree with Jamie, but if you do not have a lot of natural food source in your yard right now because the growing season hasn't started yet, we do have migratory birds coming up, and they have exhausted their energy supply by the time they get here. So leaving your feeders up maybe until the growing season starts and we start getting natural food may not be such a bad idea because it offers a quick, convenient meal for these birds that are coming up from down south.
Yeah, good point.
Roy in Lakewood, it's your turn. Hi, Roy.
Well, hi. I know all of you, but I just came up to check out my maple syrup operation, which is in its last gasp, G-A-S-P-S for the season. From a standpoint of climate change, we're 50% below our last year when we gathered 86 gallons out of 400 taps. But the other side of the coin is I've been here now without my wife and without my family, all by myself in the great Northwood, watching migratory birds. The other morning I got up, and here was a blob of a head on the edge of the ice. And I looked, and all of a sudden I realized I had a great big otter. That otter would come up through the rotting ice, pop up, make a big explosion, dive, come back up again with a fish in its mouth, and did this about three times.
Uh-oh.
And I didn't have my camera handy at the time. I turned around the next day, and here were six crows sitting on at the bottom of our bird feeder, eating along with three gray squirrels of various colors. Then I looked out the next day, and here were six drake mallards and one hen. And, of course, that hen was getting a little bit frustrated with all the attention. And they finally came back a day or so later. But it's just been an interesting season, as you say, watching the migratory birds coming back while we're not feeding the ducks. We do keep sunflower seed out for the juncos are coming back, and the little old black-capped chickadees seem to know when there's no feed in the feeder, and they cheep, 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 and I get out there and put it on, and before I get some sunflower seeds on the feeder, they're already on the edge looking at me as if to say, it's about time. But I just thought I'd let you know there's some good things about spring. And the maple syrup season, well, we'll see what happens this weekend. It froze last night, and we'll see if we can get maybe 100 gallons yet out of 400 taps when we pull up Saturday.
So even though you're missing your wife and family, it sounds like you have plenty of company up there.
Yes, I do. And believe it or not, it's great. And I do a lot of work with the Northeast Wisconsin Land Trust and have the opportunity to do monitors of five properties over the area from Niagara, Wisconsin, all the way down to central Wisconsin. And it is a pleasure. I missed my calling. I should not have been a journalist. I should have been doing what you and Jamie do. How's that?
Nice hearing from you, Roy. Take care.
Yeah, thanks,
all right,
Roy.
Thanks, all.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Oh, what a great call. Diane in Franklin, we'll turn to you. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I kind of wanted to talk again about a little bit more information about sandhill crane hunt. Do they really do enough damage? Is it just because there's so many of them? And what about the issue of whooping cranes? And are musk hunters able to tell the difference quickly? I know a couple hunters that think they know everything, but they really don't know a lot about a lot of birds. Not every hunter, of course.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, Go ahead, Dave.
Those are good questions. Certainly, you know, there are farmers who do complain about sandhill crane damage to newly planted corn crops in particular and things like that. So, you know, the species are harvested for a variety of reasons. Part of it is to keep them in balance with the ecology and the ecosystem. Part of it is it's a cost-efficient way to maintain and regulate populations. It certainly is a fundraising opportunity for the Department of Natural Resources. They can revenue, revenue generation, things like that. So there's a variety of reasons why people would want to harvest sandhill cranes. In addition, they are relatively tasty to eat. The breast meat is very, very good. So there's a lot of people who would be interested in harvesting sandhill cranes. In terms of confusing sandhill cranes with whooping cranes, you would have to really make a pretty big mistake to make a confusion, because whooping cranes are all white with the exception of the black wingtips, whereas sandhill cranes are predominantly gray, and there really is a stark difference even when they're flying, and even if you were to be looking at them over the barrel of a shotgun, for example. But in other instances where harvest seasons are occurring and there is potential for confusion with some other species that may not be a harvested species, you know, typically what happens is the Department of Natural Resources or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in terms of a migratory species, they do a tremendous amount of hunter education to help identify the proper species that is able to be harvested versus the species that you should not harvest. And if people either make a mistake or they intentionally are egregious about shooting the wrong species and they're caught doing that, certainly there's a regulatory and a legal framework in place to find people, take them to court if necessary, suspend their hunting license and things like that. So there is enough incentive for responsible legal hunters to make sure that they've identified the proper species before harvesting that animal.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling, Diane. Appreciate it. I want to turn next to Joy in Madison. Joy, your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm wondering what the rules are for harvesting mature trees during nesting season. I saw a construction site in Middleton in the last 2 years. It was first week in May, I think, and they were cutting down large trees. And I just wonder how the timing works or how that works.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know of the specific statute or how it might be worded, but I would imagine this comes into play if you're in the know, if you know that there is a nesting endangered threatened species or any migratory species, just as the case if you have, let's say, a robin nesting on your front porch light, you're not able to remove that nest, remove any young, anything like that, until that nest has completely either fledged or been destroyed by a predator. So if they're aware and there's proof that there's an animal nesting in there, I imagine that they would be protected as well. But otherwise, you can certainly still harvest trees, cut trees throughout the nesting season. It's just individual trees. Yeah. You typically want to be looking at them and see if you see some sort of nest, and then you would certainly leave it be. Because there are other things like flying squirrels that nest in trees that you might be thinking about harvesting, and you wouldn't be aware of that per se because they might be inside during the day.
Yeah, and it certainly depends on the species of bird, but most of the songbird species, that they will have multiple nests over the course of a breeding season. So if the tree gets harvested, for example, or cut, and their nest gets destroyed, they're very incentivized to go get rebred and re-nest in some other tree someplace else. So it's unlikely that it's going to have any type of a long-term detrimental effect on that particular individual bird or the species.
Well, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Mike in Denmark, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, hi, everyone. Hey, I have a question, and then talk about my albino squirrels. First, a red-tailed hawk a couple years ago. I drive a truck for a living, and I was going down the Interstate 41 or something like that, and it was just circling in the middle of the interstate, and normally, you know, a bird's coming at a vehicle, and it'll quickly get out of the way. But this thing flew right into the windshield of my truck, and it died instantly. Would that hawk have been sick or diseased, or would it have just been old to react like that? And then the second part is we have two albino squirrels in our neighborhood, and they come to my backyard. How uncommon is that to have two albino squirrels or offspring of an albino be an albino?
Okay.
So as far as the hawk, it was probably none of the options you kind of threw out there in terms of how old it was, or was it diseased or sick. You know, red-tailed hawks are often seen foraging along road right-of-ways, the medians, because they're after small mammals. And so they soar and then will, you know, prey on small mammals or rabbits and things like that. So they're also they're a broad-wing hawk, not like an accipiter, that is more of a fighter pilot and able to make quick maneuvers. So due to the nature and how they're able to fly and maneuver, they can't react quickly. So chances are, and I see this a lot in terms of driving on the interstates, you see a hawk maybe fly from left to right across the interstate to perch on the right-of-way fencing, right, and then be able to look for small mammals. So chances are this was a hawk that was moving and hunting or relocating to a different perch and just was not able to get out of the way or anticipate the approach of your vehicle and flew into the windshield or was hit by the windshield, probably didn't, you know, necessarily fly into it. But and as far as the albino squirrels, I'm guessing, are not as common as the melanistic or the black squirrels, but that, again, is going to be a genetic trait that's passed on. And again, can be just like black squirrels. You're going to see those tend to be more common in certain areas as those genetics are being passed. So certainly not that common. And albinos, true albinos, will be all white with pink eyes or red eyes as well. So
there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Janelle on Facebook asks, how much land do you have to own to apply for the Woodlands Wildlife Management Program, or COVERT program?
Yeah, thanks, Janelle. That's the Wisconsin Coverts Project we mentioned at the opening of the show. And there is no minimum acreage. It is primarily a woodland habitat management program, so we're looking for folks who have wooded acreage. But we kind of balance your outreach potential on the application, how you might share the information that you've learned, with how many acres you own. So for instance, an absentee landowner with 1,000 acres that maybe isn't, you know, connected within the local community, that's fine. We still have an opportunity to impact 1,000 acres of wooded habitat in Wisconsin. And also we've had folks, who just do a lot of outreach in their daily jobs or only have a few acres but are very connected and involved. Maybe they're a master naturalist or so on, and we want to get them through the program because we know they're going to share the information. So we take everything into consideration. So I encourage you to apply.
Yeah, I was trying to remember how many acres my friend Kurt has. It's maybe 20 acres. Not a huge amount.
Not a huge amount, but some of those are our best advocates for forest and wildlife management.
Yeah. Do you, flying squirrels, too early for young ones right now?
It might be a little bit early, I think. I'm trying to think about when we go up to summer camp, end of May, but...
Yeah, we've never seen
them this early
at that point. But
summer, you know, when do they usually come?
But they're a cavity nester, so they could certainly. I mean, it's probably not. It's nothing maybe terribly unusual for them to be out this early. I don't know the specific time when they nest, but
yeah.
But you know, with squirrels, they typically have multiple litters
throughout
the course of the year. So yeah. it's probably not unusual.
And I hope people go to our Facebook page because we've got lots more. We had a cedar waxwing, a great shot of a cedar waxwing. We've got
finches.
And some information from Donna sent a nice photo for the guy who's interested in chipmunk attraction, a photo of here's what you should do to get them, and ending with a nice shot of an eagle. With that, we are out of time. Thank you so much, Jamie and David. We'll love to have you back, and you will be back in a couple of months.
Yeah,
we'll
thank you.
Over again. Jamie Nack and David Drake from the UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.